You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, and welcome to the Explorers Podcast. Today is part 4 in our series on Spanish conquistador Hernan Cortes and the conquest of Mexico. A couple of notes before we start. First, I have put a map of the Valley of Mexico, where much of our action takes place today, on our website, explorerspodcast.com. I recommend taking a look at it so you can better enjoy this episode. And second, I want to make a comment about some pronunciations in this series. There are a lot of Aztec names in these episodes, people, places, and gods, and so forth. I want to point out that some of these names don't sound very much like they are spelled. I want to mention that because you may look at a map and see a place spelled T-L-A-X-C-A-L-A and think it will be pronounced something like Tlaxcala. But in reality, I'm saying Tlaxcala. In the end, the Aztec language, Nahuac, just doesn't always look how it is pronounced in English. Also, many of these places have both an Aztec name as well as a Spanish name, so that can be confusing, and I know that I mix them up, which probably doesn't help. These things are not a huge deal, but I wanted to point them out in case anyone gets confused by some of the odd spellings you may come across. Anyhow, that is it. On with the show. It was November 1519, and Hernan Cortes and his army, roughly 300 to 400 Spanish soldiers, 6,000 Tlaxcalan Indian allies, and several hundred porters, had crossed over the mountains and descended into the Valley of Mexico. Their destination was Tenochtitlan, the capital of the Aztec Empire. Cortes had been invited to the legendary city by Emperor Montezuma following the massacre at Cholula, where the Spanish and their allies had slaughtered 5,000 Cholulans, who Cortes claimed were planning to ambush him and his men. The massacre was horrific, and it really demonstrates just how ruthless of a man Cortes could be when he felt threatened. Once over the mountains, Cortes and his army followed deep switchbacks into the valley, where they could see lakes, cities, and towns, as well as fields of maize and beans. Eventually, the army would come to the first settlements, where they would be fed and, as always, be treated as a source of astonishment. The Spanish weapons and armor, as well as the horses and dogs, terrified and thrilled all who saw them. I also want to note that many of these people were frightened not just by Cortes, but by the thousands of Indians with him. The number I use is 6,000, but other sources put it as low as 5,000 and as high as 10,000. No matter, thousands of armed Tlaxcalan warriors were an alarming sight to the local Indians. The Spanish scared the Aztecs, but also enthralled them. However, the Tlaxcalans were a known enemy, and word of their rampage at Cholula no doubt made people wary of their presence. Despite all of this, Cortes and his men were welcomed as they descended into the Valley of Mexico. The captain general was surprised, and pleased, to find an undercurrent of discord amongst many of these people. They resented the high taxes imposed upon them, as well as the strict rule of Montezuma and his officials. Cortes loved this kind of stuff. He saw opportunities, and even told some of the leaders that he might be able to help them with their burdens in the future. Eventually, emissaries of Montezuma would arrive to greet the Spanish, bringing gifts of quetzal feathers and gold. As you can imagine, the latter drove the Spanish into a tizzy. There are also stories that there were sorcerers amongst the emissaries, sent by Montezuma to try and curse or to charm the Spanish, but to no avail. The Spanish would approach the Aztec cities from the southeast, reaching the southernmost of the five interconnected lakes in the Valley of Mexico. This was Lake Chalco. By the way, regarding the five lakes, these were fed by springs as well as runoff from the mountains. There was no connecting river. As a result, they were quite swampy. However, the Aztecs would build nearly 100 structures, dikes and levees and so forth, to improve the quality of the water and to keep it from becoming stagnant. We will talk a bit about this later. The Spanish would be met by Cacamatzin, the nephew of Montezuma and the king of Texcoco, which was located on the eastern shore of the lake of the same name. Texcoco was part of the Aztec Triple Alliance, and widely seen as the second most powerful city in the region after Tenochtitlan. The Texcoco king, Cacamatzin, came with much fanfare and grandeur, arriving in a litter decorated with silver and jewels and feathers. It was a lavish display, unlike any ever seen before by the Spanish. The king would escort the Spanish to the city of Iztapalapa, which was across the lake from Tenochtitlan. Iztapalapa was ruled by Cuitlahuac, the brother of Montezuma. The Spanish were impressed by the beauty and craftsmanship and quality of the city, as well as the other communities they had seen on the march into the Valley of Mexico. So, a few geography notes. Tenochtitlan was on an island, about 5 square miles in size, on the western side of Lake Texcoco, which was about 30 miles wide. By the way, I misrepresented the size of Lake Texcoco in the first episode, saying it was much smaller. Not a big deal, but I thought I would acknowledge that. To get to Tenochtitlan, 3 causeways had been constructed. Each, if I have done my calculations correctly, was roughly 3 to 5 miles in length. The causeways were straight and made of stone. They were essentially raised roads. The Aztecs built bridges into the causeways, which allowed small boats and canoes to travel under them. These bridges could be removed, like a drawbridge, if the city was attacked. With the drawbridges raised, the city was very difficult to get into or out of. The descriptions of their width varies. Cortes says they were as wide as a lance, which would have made them about 10 to 12 feet wide. Bernal Diaz, one of Cortes's captains, said the causeways were wide enough for 10 horses to walk side by side, which would have been upwards of 30 feet. No matter, they were great innovations. The causeway from Iztapalapa to Tenochtitlan was called the Tepeyac Causeway and was approximately 5 miles long. On November 8, 1519, the Spanish assembled to march into the Aztec capital. Cortes would pull out all the stops for the event. He and his men wore their battle armor and finest clothing. Swords and helmets were polished, banners and flags were unfurled. And all around the causeway, canoes were waiting to watch the approach of the mysterious strangers from the east. The Spanish and their Indian allies would set out across the causeway, accompanied by the Aztec nobles, Cuitlahuac and Cacamatzin. As the Spanish advanced, they marveled at what they saw. Stone aqueducts, 2.5 miles long, brought fresh water from the surrounding countryside to the city, as the lake's water was brackish, especially on the eastern side, and was not the best for drinking or bathing. And to the east, the Spanish could see a great dike, 10 miles long, 25 feet high, and 3 to 4 feet wide. Its principal function was to protect the city of Tenochtitlan from the high water levels in Lake Texcoco, but it also kept much of the brackish waters from the lake away from the area around the capital city. The lake, by the way, had many islands on it. Some were dedicated to growing flowers or specific plants. Also, there were these things called chinampas, essentially floating gardens. And I want to take a sidetrack here and talk about them because they are A, really cool, and B, a really cool way to understand just how innovative the Aztecs were. The chinampas were really quite brilliant. The Aztecs essentially secured these massive rafts on the lake, and on them dumped piles of lake bottom soil and human waste, creating these incredibly fertile islands, which were fed by the water table below. In a land where you had a lot of people and limited space for growing crops, finding a way to produce more food is critical, so this is perfect. You build floating gardens, providing the city with an additional source of produce. Again, this is a really cool engineering feat, and I want to point it out because sometimes I try and talk about how advanced the people of this region were, but what we focus on is the grandeur, like the soaring temples and the great causeways and the huge public markets. All of that is amazing, but it is not the whole story. It's often these smaller things, like the chinampas, that really demonstrate how innovative and sophisticated the Aztec people were. Now, unfortunately, for all their ingenuity, the Aztecs lacked the ability to work metal like the Europeans. This was a key piece of technology they did not possess, and it will be their downfall. Okay, sidetrack done. So as Cortez and his men marched across the causeway towards Tenochtitlan, both sides, Spanish and Aztec, marveled at the other. In addition to being accompanied by Cacamatzin and Cuitlahuac, Cortez rode with his translator, La Malinche. By the way, she had become, or would become, Cortez's mistress, and would be a valued advisor to him. It is said the Aztec people were in awe of her, as she was held in such obvious esteem by Cortez. The 5-mile march across the causeway passed without incident, and Cortez and his army were led over a drawbridge onto the main island, right to the gates of Tenochtitlan. After a welcoming ceremony, the Spanish would wait for the arrival of Montezuma. This was a monumental moment. Two complex civilizations who had not known of each other until a few years ago, civilizations that had evolved independently, were now coming together. The Emperor of the Aztecs would arrive in the center of two long processions of nobles, all elaborately dressed in their finest clothing. Montezuma would be carried on a gold-plated litter, adorned with quetzal feathers and decorated with gold, silver, and gems. When the litter stopped, Montezuma emerged. Cloaks were laid before the emperor, so his feet did not touch the ground as he walked. His servants, per custom, did not look directly at their lord. Montezuma wore gold-soled sandals and a brilliant green headdress with quetzal feathers. His cotton cloak was studded with jewels. His lower lip was said to be pierced with a blue stone hummingbird, and his nose and ears were also pierced. It is said that Montezuma walked with grace and dignity. Not surprising, as he had commanded his people for nearly 2 decades, and his word was law. When the emperor approached the Spanish, Cortez reportedly tried to embrace Montezuma, but was quickly stopped by aides of the Aztec ruler. No touchy the emperor. The ceremony that followed was long and elaborate, with Cortez being introduced to many Aztec nobles. When done, Cortez presented the emperor with a necklace of pearls and cut glass, and through his translator, La Malinche, asked, "Are you Montezuma?" The emperor replied, "Yes, I am." Gifts for the Spanish would follow, and that included necklaces and jewelry and gold and flowers. Like beautiful feathers, the Aztecs loved flowers, and they were highly prized in their culture. The emperor had extensive gardens in the city and on the islands and the surrounding lakes. At this point, Montezuma departed, saying that he would meet with Cortez later. The Spanish were then led into the city. They were taken to an expansive compound in the northwest section of Tenochtitlan, near the Tlacopan Causeway. This was the palace of Axayacatz. Axayacatz had been Montezuma's father and the previous emperor. The compound was large and able to house the entire army, upwards of 7,000 people. It was comfortable, and the men, even the Tlaxcalans, were well cared for. The palace had a walled central courtyard, and Cortez and his officers immediately went about fortifying the location. Cannons were placed on the walls, and guards were stationed at key points. Almost immediately, the Spanish conducted some military drills in the courtyard, mainly to fire off their weapons, a way to frighten the Aztecs. It was a tactic that would work. None of these people had heard such thunder. Later that day, Cortez and his top officers would be summoned by the emperor. Here, they would be given more gifts, an extravagant display of the wealth and power of Montezuma. In addition to woven garments, feathers, and textiles, there was gold and silver in quantities greater than any of the men had ever seen in their lives. Both sides exchanged polite words, with Cortez assuring Montezuma that he was a friend to the emperor. The Spanish would depart peacefully and be invited to enjoy the splendors of Montezuma's city. All in all, it had been a successful day for Cortez. He had impressed the Aztecs, and any fears about being ambushed had been unfounded. However, Cortez and his men were keenly aware of their vulnerability. They were on an island of more than 200,000 people, and the only way off, the three causeways, could be shut down at a moment's notice. If things went badly and they needed to retreat, they were in for a world of hurt. On the positive side, the Spanish were in a defensible position and for now on good terms with their hosts. Cortez and his men were now free to wander the city, and as we have said, Tenochtitlan was a magnificent place. The city housed over 200,000 people, making it as large as any in Europe save for Constantinople. The markets of Tenochtitlan were astounding. There were slaves and textiles and food and pottery and skins and a million other items available. You could also find chocolate and tobacco, both unknown to the Europeans at this time. Cortez reported that 60,000 people came to the market every day, but this is likely an exaggeration. Historians say it was probably closer to 20,000, still immense. The city had many other highlights. There were extensive botanical gardens, an aquarium, a huge ball court, plus a great aviary and zoo. In them, you could find crocodiles, jaguars, snakes, mountain lions, eagles, falcons, hawks, as well as the beautiful plumed birds so beloved by the Aztecs. 300 people were employed caring for the animals. Cortez would be given a tour of the city center, a massive complex of more than 100 rooms. Here he would see not only the administrative center of the empire, but its finest craftsmen, such as jewelers and potters and feather workers. They were the best of the best, and Cortez said that they produced goods equal or better than their European counterparts. The city itself was orderly and well-maintained. There was an advanced sewer system, and the streets were cleaned daily. And we can't forget the grand palaces and homes. It was said that Montezuma's palace was guarded by 3,000 men and had 1,000 servants, and he only had the finest in all aspects of life. It is said that the emperor would touch a bowl or goblet or plate only a single time in his entire life. And the marvels did not stop there. We mentioned the aqueducts earlier, which brought fresh water to the city. Also, there were canals that had been dug all over the island, allowing boats and canoes to travel in an orderly and efficient manner throughout the city. Another amazing thing was how many buildings were constructed not just on the island, but in the waters around the island. These buildings hugged the shores and extended out over the lake. All of this was wondrous, but nothing garnered the Spaniards' attention like the city's temples. These were extraordinary, and none so towering as Templo Mayor, the main temple of the city. It was dedicated to Huitzilopochtli, the god of war and sacrifice, and Tlaloc, the god of rain. Each had a shrine at the top of the pyramid. The temple of Huitzilopochtli was the personal shrine of Montezuma. The great temple was about 200 feet high and 260 by 330 feet at its base. It dominated the city, physically and spiritually. A few days after arriving, Cortez asked to see the temple, a request he was granted, which was a rare thing. The climb was steep, with over 100 steps, and Cortez and his men were winded when they reached the top. We can't forget that they were at an altitude of more than 7,000 feet, which they were not accustomed to. Inside the temple, they were repulsed by what they saw. This was where much of the human sacrifice took place, and the Spanish were overwhelmed by the sight and smell of it all. There were thousands upon thousands of skulls in the temple, and blood was everywhere. Cortez, never one to be subtle, tried to preach to Montezuma about the merits of Christianity and attacked the Aztec emperor's religion, condemning the blood sacrifice. He even told Montezuma that he should erect a cross at the top of the temple. The emperor was patient with Cortez at first, but cut him off when the captain general attacked the Aztecs' religious views. Cortez, wisely, did not press the issue at this time. He would, however, have a chapel constructed at his army's compound, with Montezuma even providing supplies and laborers to aid in the efforts. Thus, here was Cortez and his army in a fortified position in the heart of the Aztec emperor. Tenochtitlan had surpassed their wildest dreams. It was so mesmerizing, Cortez would call it, quote, the city of dreams, end quote.
Napoleon Bonaparte rose from obscurity to become the most powerful and significant figure in modern history. Over 200 years after his death, people are still debating his legacy. He was a man of contradictions, a tyrant and a reformer, a liberator and an oppressor, a revolutionary and a reactionary. His biography reads like a novel, and his influence is almost beyond measure. I'm Everett Rummage, host of the Age of Napoleon podcast, and every month I delve into the turbulent life and times of one of the greatest characters in history, and explore the world that shaped him in all its glory and tragedy. It's a story of great battles and campaigns, political intrigue, and massive social and economic change, but it's also a story about people, populated with remarkable characters. I hope you'll join me as I examine this fascinating era of history. Find The Age of Napoleon wherever you get your podcasts.
So, Cortez had made it. He had reached the city. He had met the emperor. What to do next? Well, that is easier said than done, because to be honest, we are entering a very murky section of our narrative. We get confusing and conflicting stories. And knowing exactly what happened is almost impossible. However, we do know the end result, which is the most important thing. With that said, buckle up. I am going to take you through some of these muddy waters until it clears. Here we go. Sometime between November of 1519 and April of 1520, we will see Cortez take Montezuma hostage. The Spanish claim this happened in November, not long after arriving in Tenochtitlan. They say it was in response to an attack on some Spanish troops in the east by Aztec forces. This attack left 7 Spaniards dead, including Juan de Escalante, the Spanish commander at Veracruz. Some sources say that Cortez took Montezuma back to his compound and had him run the empire from there, with Cortez pulling all the strings. Other sources claim that Montezuma was kept at his own palace, but under the watchful eye of Cortez and his men. Either way, the result was the same. While he tried to put on a good face to save his dignity, Montezuma was humiliated by this. In fact, his humiliation was so great, he feared for his own life if he returned to his people, who hated him for becoming a pawn of the Spanish. As you can imagine, dissent grew during the pseudo-imprisonment of the emperor. A plot to free Montezuma and destroy the Spanish, led by the emperor's nephew, Cacamatzin, would be uncovered that spring. This would lead to the arrest of the king of Texcoco and other prominent Aztec nobles. They would be placed by men loyal to Montezuma, and thus Cortes. Okay, that is one take on things. However, I find some of it hard to believe. That Cortes could keep the emperor on a string for months and months is just not that plausible. At some point, the emperor or his people could have engineered an escape, or a rebellion, or something. But it's hard to believe that it went on for 5 months. I guess the whole Stockholm Syndrome thing could have been in effect here. But the idea that Montezuma, who was not a simpleton and had ruled a massive empire for 2 decades, would be so awed and overwhelmed by a people he could not understand, even if they did have firearms and swords, is kind of hard to believe. But again, maybe Montezuma had allowed it all to happen, believing that the Spanish would go away once they had all the loot that they could carry. We just don't know. So, what is the alternative? Well, some argue that Cortes and the Spanish operated on roughly friendly terms with the Aztecs and Montezuma for a lot longer than just a couple of weeks, maybe all the way up to April of 1520. In this time, Cortes and his men were guests of the emperor and came and went to his palace, and perhaps vice versa. Montezuma, after all, was said to have been a very curious man, and it would not have been out of place for him to visit Cortes to understand more about their technology and customs, not to mention to just determine the intentions of the Spanish. Now, one of the things many people have a problem with regarding Montezuma is the fact that he invited the Spanish to Tenochtitlan in the first place. I mean, why do this? Had not Cortes and his men attacked the people of Cholula? Had they not allied themselves with the Tlaxcalans, a traditional enemy of the Aztecs? Yet here were the Spanish, royally welcomed right into the capital. I'd like to argue that this could have been done for several reasons. First, we have to take into consideration the idea that Montezuma did not really see the Spanish as a threat, but more of a curiosity. Let me explain this. Even after all the reports of the Spanish victory against the Tlaxcalans and the slaughter at Cholula, I do not believe that Montezuma ever dreamed there was any way he could be usurped. He was, after all, the ruler of the greatest empire in the world, as far as he knew. And as we said last time, the Aztec Empire was a mountain. You just do not sweep aside a mountain. Thus, he welcomed Cortes, believing that no matter what happened, his position and that of the Aztec Empire was safe. And he certainly never imagined that the Spanish would do something as audacious as take him prisoner. Second thing I want to mention is the geopolitical situation within the Aztec Empire. Montezuma and his advisors knew there was discontent amongst their allies. That's only natural for a huge, multi-ethnic, multicultural entity. The Spanish represented a threat to the stability of the empire, and it was not just Cortes. Remember, this was the 3rd year in a row the Spanish had come to Mexico. Up until now, there had only been a few hundred guys. The Aztec Empire could handle a few hundred guys, but what about the next expedition, and the next? Would there be 1,000 men, or 10,000? No matter, the Spanish had the potential to be a disruptive influence within the empire. Montezuma probably understood that simple fact. Thus, he proceeded with caution. There was no need to start an unnecessary conflict. I'm guessing that Montezuma really did not want Cortes and the Spanish in Mexico. Thus, at first, he tried some good old-fashioned bribes to get rid of them. When that didn't work, he could have elected to attack Cortes, but the Spanish had proven to be a powerful force. Thus, Montezuma brought them to where he probably felt he could observe and control, and if necessary, eliminate them. For Montezuma, he might have said, "Hey, these guys are formidable, and they aren't leaving, so let's get them to the capital where I can keep an eye on them. If they pose a threat, I can trap them and overwhelm them with my greater numbers." It is not a bad idea. Get a feel for these strangers, find out their true intentions, and if they are a threat, drop the hammer on them from a position of power. In the end, we don't really know what people were thinking or what their plans were, and we don't know exactly what happened and when it happened, but as I said, we do know the end result, and that is that Montezuma would be taken hostage by the Spanish, and a potential revolt against Cortes was uncovered and the ringleaders imprisoned. Now, before we go forward, I do want to mention some things that occurred in the early part of 1520. The first item was that Montezuma would formally cede control of the Aztec Empire to Cortes and the Spanish crown. Now you are probably asking, why would Montezuma do this? And the answer is, he probably didn't. This is one of those legal things Cortes liked to boast about. What exactly happened is, of course, confusing, but Cortes claims that Montezuma signed or agreed to a treaty giving to him, Cortes, the power of the empire. Did Montezuma really do this? Who knows? He may have agreed to something, but handing over his empire to Cortes was probably not what he believed was going on. Some argue it was simply Montezuma being agreeable and courteous, a trait of Aztec nobility. But this was a common tactic amongst Europeans for hundreds of years. They'd get the native people to sign off on something they didn't understand, and then come back later and wave it in their face. For Cortes, this was a way to help solidify his position with his king and queen. He could say to the crown, "See, look at this, the natives love me, they gave me this land, here's a legal document saying so." Another thing Cortes did was plan his escape, in case things went badly. For this, he had four brigantines constructed in Tenochtitlan. While Cortes had sunk his ships the previous year back in Veracruz, he had saved much of the gear, such as the sails. Well, he had that gear sent to Tenochtitlan, and the four ships would be constructed, led by a man named Martin Lopez. The four brigantines were about 40 to 50 feet long and could carry about 75 men. Cortes envisioned the boats as a way to escape Tenochtitlan if necessary. A third thing Cortes did was to send out small expeditions into the surrounding region. He had two main reasons for this. One was to see where the Aztecs got their gold, and the second was to feel out the local Indians and see what people might be potential allies in the future. The reports about the gold mines were encouraging. This made Cortes even more covetous of Tenochtitlan. And in the local communities, he found a deep vein of discontent, one he felt could be mined if necessary. The final thing that Cortes did was accumulate treasure. Gold, silver, gems, jewels, anything the Spanish could get their hands on was fair game. It was said that Cortes and his men discovered a great hoard of treasure in the palace they resided in, and Montezuma told them to take whatever they wanted, except for the feathers, as those belonged to the gods. So, it's roughly April of 1520. Cortes has made the emperor his hostage. He was loading up on treasure, but he saw the empire could really pay off huge the longer he stuck around. However, everyone knew that the populace was not happy. Montezuma was a hostage, but at some point, even that could not protect the Spanish. Montezuma even told Cortes this very thing, saying it was best to get out while the getting was good. With tensions simmering in the city, some of Cortes' captains encouraged their leader to abandon the city. They had a bunch of treasure, more than they ever imagined. Why not just leave before things went bad? Cortes probably hesitated to do this because it meant abandoning his greater schemes of controlling Mexico. To him, it was quite probable the expedition was not just a treasure grab anymore, but instead a way to control the entire Aztec Empire. Also, we do have to remember, he had no ships. To retreat might actually put him in a worse situation. Well, before any real decisions could be made, Cortes would be jolted into action with the arrival of a message from Veracruz. Remember Cuban Governor Diego Velázquez, the guy who had withdrawn Cortes' commission to explore and settle Mexico? The guy Cortes was working at every turn to be rid of his influence? Well, he was back. For this, let us return to July of 1519. Cortes had sent his treasure ship back to Spain full of loot and a report about his deeds in Mexico, essentially trying to sway the king and queen to his camp. Cortes had ordered the ship to go directly to Spain and not stop anywhere. But as you can guess, they did stop, in Cuba, for supplies as well as personal reasons. And as you can imagine, word of what was on the ship was not kept secret. Stories of Cortes' riches quickly spread. The ship would continue on to Spain, but Velázquez, upon hearing about it, sent his own vessels in pursuit. Luckily for Cortes, the attempt would be unsuccessful. No matter, Velázquez was enraged at what he heard. He considered Cortes a traitor. He needed to respond, and respond forcefully. For that, Velázquez turned to his trusted lieutenant, Panfilo de Narváez, who had helped in the conquest of Cuba. Narváez was a ruthless man, and loyal to the governor. Under him, Velázquez would assemble a new force, one that the governor felt could overwhelm Cortes. 19 ships, 20 cannons, 800 men, including 80 arquebusiers, 120 crossbowmen, and 80 cavalry. They departed for Veracruz on March 5th, 1520. Now, there is one caveat to this grand expedition, and that is in the form of a man named Lucas Vázquez de Ayun. Upon hearing of this big expedition be assembled by Velázquez, representatives of the Spanish crown dispatched a man to Cuba to see what was going on. This was Ayun. Ayun was sent to make sure the crown got its share of spoils, but also to ensure that the interests of the Spanish crown were upheld. And this meant trying to prevent bloodshed between Spaniards. Because, let's be honest, everyone knew what was going on. Velasquez was going after Cortes, and a confrontation was likely. It was Ayun's job to try and stop such a bloodbath. This oversight was something that will hinder Narvaez, who wanted nothing more than to march into Mexico and start cutting off some traitorous heads. I don't have an exact date on Narvaez's arrival in Mexico, but it was likely in early April. And with that, I think we are at a good spot to wrap things up. Today we got Cortes to Tenochtitlan and talked in length about the situation in the capital city. Why did Montezuma ever let Cortes come to the city? What was he thinking? How could he have let him hold a prisoner for so long, etc., etc.? To be honest, I have a hard time really believing a lot of what has been written about Montezuma. To me, it just doesn't smell right. I know that's not very scientific, but that's just my gut. But what is not in dispute is the end result. It was the spring of 1520, and Montezuma was now Cortes's hostage. But things are going to get dicey for Cortes. The native people are itching for a fight, as was his old nemesis, Governor Velasquez. In our next episode, Cortes will need to confront a Spanish army three times the size of his own, as well as face mounting troubles back in the Aztec capital. It is all going to make for a very bloody episode. So that is it for today. Thank you for listening, and I will see you next time.
Hi, I'm Mike Troy, host of the American Revolution podcast on the Airwave Media Network. This podcast is the origin story of the United States, how we went from colonies ruled by a king to the democratic republic that we have today. The American Revolution podcast tells the story of the revolution from beginning to end. Please subscribe for free. We're available on all major podcast platforms. I hope you will join me today on the American Revolution podcast.